This Week in Nuclear, Episode 79 for November 11th, 2009. Small Mobile Reactors in the U.S. Military. Welcome to the show. This is John Wheeler, and you're listening to This Week in Nuclear, a podcast about the peaceful uses of nuclear science, engineering, and technology. Today is Veterans Day in the United States, the day that we stop to reflect about the men and women of our armed forces and to acknowledge their many sacrifices and to thank them for their service to our country. This day holds a special significance for me personally because many, many of my family members and close friends are currently serving in the military or have served in the past. I have close family members who have served in every armed conflict since World War II, and probably earlier ones too if I knew that history. So to the veterans in my family, Mark, Elizabeth, Jake, Bill, if you happen to be listening to this show, this is a shout-out to you and to all your fellow sailors, soldiers, Marines, airmen, Coast Guardsmen, and merchant mariners. Thank you for your service. This world is a safer place because of your hard work, dedication, and sacrifice. And to my father, Johnny, and stepfather, Charlie, who are no longer with us, both of whom were veterans, you're in my thoughts today, too. Because it's Veterans Day, I thought it would be fitting for this show to focus on nuclear energy as it relates to its potential uses for the military. At the Thorium Energy Conference in October, I had the pleasure to meet Colonel Rogge from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He spoke about the military's rising use of energy and the problems this energy intensity creates for soldiers who are tasked with protecting our supply chains. By using a more dense source of energy, the military can reduce the amount of material they need to transport over long distances, and that will in turn save lives. Lots of lives. And this is why the military is considering small mobile reactors. So without further delay, here's Colonel Rogge at the 2009 Thorium Energy Alliance Conference.
Well, I will ask our esteemed member here, Kirk, to introduce the colonel, and I think I can't thank Kirk enough for doing that, man. That was a very good gift. Good smiling back.
Okay. Hey, it's my pleasure to introduce Colonel Paul Rogge. Colonel Rogge and I met a few months ago up in Idaho. He has been in Idaho for some years working at the Idaho National Lab. He's been recently reactivated. And he's now serving at Fort Monroe and working on the Army's energy program, which is looking very seriously at nuclear energy options. Colonel Rogge has a strong background in nuclear. He's basically a nuclear engineer with the Corps of Engineers and perhaps even more of a scientist type. But it's my great pleasure to have him and to have him serve in our country in uniform once again. Thank you, sir.
Okay, well, I'm really excited to be here. This is an exciting time for me. I grew up a long time ago, and when I was a kid in the 60s, I thought, you know, someday the world is going to really end up worrying about energy and water. Those are going to be the things that countries go to war or peace over. And I thought, water, I could try and solve that problem, become a civil engineer like my dad. And you tell people that you're a civil engineer and they say, oh, yeah, sewage and water treatment. Okay, it's exciting. Then you tell them you studied energy, which generally relates to being a nuclear engineer. That's the one discipline, really, that studies energy entirely. It's not diluted by other means. So I thought, okay, what if I study nuclear engineering? Did my theory actually work? When you walk around, if you are a nuclear engineer, I'm sure you found that any party or other forum that you tell people that's what you do, they say, wow, you must be smart. So that really worked out well. Well, it wasn't a really good time to be a nuclear engineer, especially during, say, the late 70s and 80s into the 90s. And so now I'm finding it very exciting to see that what may be a renaissance in nuclear energy, or just the fact that people are concerned about energy, to see energy issues on the news every day today, and certainly over the last few decades, that really hasn't been the case. So the reason that I'm here now, back in uniform, is that energy has become something interesting. I've spent some time trying to get DOD to care about energy. There never really was even a person that you could go to talk about energy within DOD. But just within the last couple of years, it's really become something of interest, and so I was asked to come back and help do something about that. And it's not an easy task, but you know, we didn't sign up for easy tasks. So the question before us now, and one of the reasons that I came back, is to take a look at nuclear energy and determine whether DOD should actually have some kind of a leading role in nuclear energy, or whether they should take a follow role and let things happen and market forces drive it and all that sort of thing. So that's sort of the focus. Well, why are we worried about energy at all? We need energy to win the fight. We're finding out that the soldiers walk around. The soldiers walk around the mountains of Afghanistan, and they're carrying 120 pounds of gear. And guess what? A big proportion of that is batteries or fuel or cooking tablets. And then vehicles can only go on a mission for so long before they have to come back and refuel. I think Abrams tanks get about a half mile a gallon. The airplanes have to come back and refuel. It costs, I think, $1,000 a gallon to refuel an airplane in flight. And then we're losing half our troops to escort convoys through Iraq, and this is a tougher problem. So we need energy to sustain the fight. And it's becoming a problem now because you don't have these secure supply lines that we assumed that we were going to have over the last few years. So, well, what about nuclear? If you look at all the energy sources that are out there, the various technologies, ultimately, you might conclude that you need to take a look at nuclear. It's the single available technology that could possibly displace, say, petroleum fuels as a major source of energy. We can use wind, we can use solar, we can use geothermal, we can use all sorts of things, but if you really want to displace a significant part of those millions of gallons of oil that we're burning, nuclear is the only thing that we have on the table today. Well, why don't we just conserve, follow Amory Lovin's suggestion, and just don't use as much? Not a bad idea, but the fact is that we're gradually using more and more energy to gain a combat edge out there in battlefield. We have better radios, we have sensors, we're going to have exoskeletons that soldiers use to carry more load. All of those things require power. So maybe we can do something to conserve, but in fact, we're using more and more power, so we need to do something about that. Well, logistics is one of the key issues out there today. As we watch the news now, we see IEDs going off, killing people in convoys, and so that's a big problem. We have extended supply lines that you need to guard. We have all the facilities that you use to transfer cargoes from ships to shore, to rail, to trucks and so forth, and all of that requires people, requires security forces, requires infrastructure. So that's not a simple task out there. When I was waiting to go into Iraq, just as we began the invasion in 2003, I didn't tell you I spent some time in active duty in 2003 and was actually the person who put together the project to rebuild oil systems in Iraq. And I bought fuel for the Iraqi civilian use so that they could sustain the life support functions. They could cook and they could have water and heat and so forth. And so while we were waiting to move in behind the combat forces. I listened to some of the generals expressing concern they couldn't get spare parts or other supplies up there because the convoys were busy carrying fuel and water. So there are a lot of issues related to the way that we sustain the force today with fuel, and I consider water to be basically closely tied to the fuel issue. Well, how bad is it? This is one example, but it's pretty representative. You can see a pretty large blue portion over there for water. And nowadays, that's all bottled water. And there's a big, chartreuse portion over there that's bulk fuel. And depending on what you're doing, whether you're driving and fighting or you're sitting in camps, then those numbers can shift a little bit. But they're not going to shift that much. You're still going to have the predominant portion of your supply chain to be these liquids, fuel and water. Well, not only are those large portions of the supply chain, but we're learning, some of us already learned, but we're gaining awareness of the issue that it's not very cheap to run things this way. There were some people who made the press back in 2003 with the issue that Halliburton was procuring oil from Kuwait for like $2.40 a gallon, and they bought fuel in Turkey for like $2.20 a gallon, and so there was concern that they should have been buying more from the cheaper source. Those people didn't have any idea at that point what it really took to get the fuel delivered. It was nothing anywhere near that pump price that we're paying. We're paying for the truck drivers and the security for the convoys and running supply points and all that, that dwarfed the pump price. So the $2 or $3 that we pay here for gas is nothing like what we pay to get fuel delivered to the troops. And that's beginning to be more broadly understood today. More significant than the cost of lives, I mentioned before, half of our losses in Iraq are really associated with the supply chain. People guarding convoys, they get hit by an IED or some other kind of an ambush, and people are killed in that way. And so the fewer convoys we would have to make, the fewer lives that we would lose. And in fact, the fewer combat troops you'd have to have in theater to do a given mission, because you wouldn't need that extra battalion of troops guarding convoys every day. Those people could be back home, and so could the people who are supplying that battalion of troops. So just a few old statistics to give a sense of scale. This was 4th Infantry Division. I like them because I was originally going to go into Iraq with them before Turkey held us up and said, no, you can't go into northern Iraq. But 4ID did end up going in. They did ultimately move through Kuwait into northern Iraq, and they used fuel that was trucked in from either the south from Kuwait or from the north through Turkey. And they used, say, 50,000 gallons of fuel a day. Well, that adds up. So if you look at, say, a month time, this estimate said that they would spend $30 million a month just on fuel. So, and that's for power. For the vehicles, another 120. And it depends, again, on how much driving you're doing and how much time you're spending in your base camp. And just a little aside with respect to that particular issue, is we have a more mature theater in Iraq, and I think what we're going to see in Afghanistan, people spend a lot of time in the base camps. They do a lot of their work there. They write contracts. They train the local people, or at least they come back from the patrols, and they have to rest and resupply at the base camp. So an awful lot of that fuel, more so than what was shown in the slide, is used to produce electricity. And in those cases, think about ways that you could produce electricity that you don't necessarily need to be using liquid fuel when they do for transportation. So tooth to tail, this is really the thing that gets the Army leaders excited. The real problem, as far as the division commander in Iraq is concerned, is not that it's costing $150 million a month for fuel. It's the fact that he's got to dedicate a battalion of troops to be out on the road every day guarding convoys. And I've got air cover guarding the convoys and responding to the attacks. And I've got UAVs that are diverted to monitor those supply routes. And I've got operational people who are coordinating those security forces and the delivery of the supplies. So that all detracts from doing whatever it is that I'm there to do in the first place. If I'm there to find Al-Qaeda, if I'm there to teach people to grow something other than poppies, if I'm there to restore essential services and help people to build a stable economic and political environment, I have that much less resource and even my management tensions to bring from doing those things because of the way that we do supply today. So just imagine another way of doing things where you brought your energy with you. And this picture actually includes a shot of the ML-1 reactor, which was operated in late 50s, early 60s. So it's a reactor that we already had in the Army inventory way back when. And this is providing energy to a power grid that supplies more electric weapons, it supplies the tents and their TVs and computers and air conditioners, potentially even somehow it fuels the vehicles in one way or another. Maybe it charges their batteries, produces hydrogen to go into their hydride cells, or makes synthetic hydrocarbon fuel, somehow runs the vehicles. And of course, the electronic systems, which not only might protect this base, but they might protect out beyond the base itself. They might have longer range capabilities. So in this scenario, you don't entirely do away with resupply. You still have to get medical supplies. You still have to get food. You still have to get people in and out. You have to evacuate casualties. But you saw the numbers before, and if you can address the liquid fuel and water piece of that, you really open up some options as far as logistics and security. So this is kind of a different view, but the question is then how would you do that? Well, nuclear would be, as I mentioned before, the only technology we know of today that could replace all these vast quantities of liquid petroleum fuel. So why might you look at nuclear? Well, I just mentioned, but it's high energy density, the fuel is self-contained, so you're not shipping in new fuel every day on these long convoys. As it turns out, more and more of the combat systems that we're operating out there, or even non-combat systems, run off electricity. There's an internal combustion engine that gets the vehicle there, but the radars and the computers, and now we're looking at directed energy weapons, all of those things run off of electricity. So we're becoming more electric force in the Army, just as the Navy is in ships and the Air Force is with airplanes. So electricity isn't necessarily, you know, a bad thing to produce. Nuclear can have a low signature, doesn't make as much noise typically. Doesn't it give off some of the gases? It certainly gives off heat, but the signature can be much less. We might be able to get the fuel domestically. We don't have to go to places like Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Indonesia, Iran to get the fuel that provides us our national security. We might get something from, say, Lemhi Pass, Idaho, which is about 50 miles from my house, actually, back in Idaho. Proven technologies. I had a picture up there before of the transportable reactor that we operated in the 50s and 60s. So surely we can figure it out today. And then besides that, if DOD were to take the initiative and move some of these technologies forward and build the capability to generate energy, generate power from energy in a distributed way, maybe in remote locations, there might be benefit to the rest of the world. So why not? Well, this probably isn't any surprise to most of you. Certainly public opinion has been against nuclear for the last few decades. that seems to be changing a little bit, but I hear very frequently the opinion that you just can't sell nuclear. Usually, what I hear is, I don't think it's so bad, but nobody else will buy it. It's everybody else that's going to be against it. Proliferation concerns we started to talk about this morning, they had to cut that off. So clearly, there are plenty of people concerned about that. Investment challenges, I think, are key, both for the military and for the civilian world. And we just had a little bit of a chat about that during the break. But one of the big challenges for new reactor designs is that you're talking about technology that isn't as mature in the market. We have light water reactors out there operating all over the U.S. People have been buying and building them. You've got the fuel supply chain built in. You've got the training. Now, if you want to build some kind of an advanced reactor, the next generation, there are some things that need to be developed. The time to market and the perceived risk of those things might be a little bit higher. The U.S. economy doesn't seem to be really supporting those things that are long-term investments, maybe higher investment, higher risk. So one of the opportunities the military has is to go ahead and take those risks and make those investments, because our decision process isn't as driven by short-term amortization payback on investment. We have some other considerations. So what DOD, I think, needs to do is take a look at those other considerations and see if it does fit in our investment portfolio philosophy and see if that's the right thing for DOD to do. Certainly, simplicity is important. People don't perceive nuclear as being something that's simple. That's why people say, gee, you must be smart when you say I'm a nuclear engineer. Environmental concerns, that's kind of an interesting topic, because the reason people are starting to change their attitude about nuclear is in large part because of environmental concerns. We see mountaintops being leveled in West Virginia. We see polar bears stranded on icebergs. And so there's some growing recognition of the environmental impacts of non-nuclear energy sources. Lastly, the thing that I am really working on within DOD is this issue of the fact that there's a whole lot of issues. So what we may do over the next 6-8 months within DOD is to conduct some kind of a study that would look at nuclear energy and look at Army or DOD energy needs and see how do those mesh up. And the reason that hasn't happened, I think, is because it's a tough question. There's a lot of issues, a lot of pros, a lot of cons. It's quite a change from what we're doing today. And so you have to bring together a lot of people with different areas of expertise, different perspectives, to try and get your arms around all that. And you have to take kind of a systematic approach. So it's not going to be a simple study, but I think we may have enough support today to actually start up something like that. So I mentioned before energy alternatives. We have soldier systems out there today using thin film technology. You can lay down a solar panel and charge up your batteries out in some distant outpost, and those are great. I've seen just recently some transportable wind turbines that you can set up a tripod and crank the thing up, and it spins the wind turbine and generates some electricity for your remote application. Those are great. I saw Admiral Bowman speak one time about a year ago on nuclear issues, and I think he made a really good point. We need to do all those things. We need to do the solar, we need to do the wind, we need to probably develop some of our unconventional resources out there. We also need nuclear. It's not like we have all this energy resource and availability to burn. We pretty much need to go after the things that we can. This chart here is one of the things that I use to talk to some of the military leaders about. They really don't understand until you put this table up that, yeah, you can have battery-powered vehicles. Of course, we have to charge them up somehow. They don't really carry enough energy to do much. So you end up with a liquid fuel economy. And you jump up a couple orders of magnitude, and you have to drive around your vehicles with liquid fuel. Well, that is not energy dense enough, though, to provide the sort of sustainability that we need out there in Iraq, maybe, but in Afghanistan for certain. We can't afford to be driving around the countryside in Afghanistan delivering fuel from wherever. They don't even have a port that you can ship in the fuel and truck it. So then you take several other orders of magnitude step up in energy density, and all of a sudden you've got this energy source that we've been using for decades and provides 20% of our energy domestically, frontier force way ahead of us. And so that's why we need to take a look at it. So we all know nuclear energy isn't one thing. There's a lot of variations from RTGs that we shoot off past Pluto in space that provide reliable power for a long, long time, to the big reactors that we have all over the country operating safely and providing inexpensive power. We've got a lot of different reactor concepts, different coolants, moderators, fuels, all that sort of thing. So you can probably tailor something that's going to meet your needs with nuclear energy. There's a lot of options out there. So what are the applications? Well, there's one of the application areas that could be interesting to nuclear is the sort of the remote system package. Either you have something like an aerostat that you want to have up in the air providing persistent surveillance for a year at a time. You don't want to be trying to deliver fuel to this thing every few days, right? So nuclear is well suited to that. If you can provide this source that just keeps chugging away, it's like the Energizer Bunny, it just keeps going and going. And that's why we use the nuclear sources in space systems. But what do you need to do to design those systems appropriately for the mission? Well, they need to have long endurance, they need to be reliable, they need to be rugged, not prone to proliferation, because you may not be manning this thing. You may be out in the middle of nowhere someplace. Well, another application area would be transportable energy. We had that picture several slides ago of the operating base somewhere in Central Asia, Southwest Asia, Timbuktu. Actually, it could be Africa. We're certainly starting to look at Africa from a military standpoint. You want to be able to take this energy source with you and move it when you move. So what do you need that to do? Well, it needs to not require a lot of resupply. The whole idea is you don't have to keep running the resupply convoys. It would be good if it's air transportable. A lot of the places that you would want to deploy this, for the same reasons that you don't want to keep running supply convoys, you don't really want to have to truck this in. Or maybe very difficult to truck in a large, heavy vehicle. It's one thing to move a truck around, say, the East Coast or West Coast. It's quite another to be in some mountain pass in Afghanistan. It really limits the size of the package you can take in. Again, you need rugged, proliferation-resistant packages. You know, you can have people coming in and shooting at you. Ultimately, you could have somebody overrun a site, and you don't want them to get their hands on something that they could use against you that wouldn't be easier to get some other way. And it needs to be safe and simple, because part of the idea was, I don't have my soldiers out there running the supply chain. I have them fighting. Well, I don't want them running my nuclear reactor and central plant either. So it needs to be very simple, and it needs to be reliable so that we're not having to fix it, or we're not without the energy. And then, of course, there's installation power. I think civilians may not really have an awareness today of how much the military is now concerned about the power on military bases, even within the U.S. We have a number of bases just in the continental United States that perform critical missions. We have people flying UAVs in Iraq from an Air Force base in the U.S. We have people running sensor systems and collecting information and providing real-time information to people in theater from places in the U.S. And if somebody were to come in and do something to our power grid, or even if something, say a natural disaster, were to affect the power grid and disrupt the energy supply to our compass bases, that could be a bad thing for national security. We could end up not being able to support the troops out in the field, maybe not be able to provide fire support during some kind of an operation, give them critical information, and it could be a problem for a long time. There's some predictions that we could have a power grid disruption that would take months or more to restore with the grid in its current condition. So there's a growing interest in building more robust capability in U.S. bases to provide for the energy needs. And that could take a lot of different forms. Certainly, diversifying your energy sources is useful, and so a lot of bases are looking at renewables. There's a lot of talk about wanting to be able to island your base and have it self-sustaining, and there's probably some good operational discussion to be had, you know, whether you just close the gates and operate or whether you really have to consider the community. But the point is that the installations are also something to take a look at because they have some energy security needs that we really are becoming aware of. So what are the efforts today? Well, of course, the Navy already has as many reactors as the civilian sector does. So it's not like DOD is not in the nuclear business. However, that's about all that we're doing. The Army has one reactor, really, that's still operating at all. It's not a power reactor. It's doing some material testing. Other than that, you know, it's all talk. The Air Force last year responded to some suggestions, and they were looking at the potential to put a nuclear reactor on an installation. Timing wasn't very good. The Air Force had a change in leadership right after that time due to some other factors, nuclear related in part. And so I think that lost some momentum. The Army wasn't as quick off the blocks on this topic, but I'm hoping that we find that we've got more endurance on the topic. And so we may be reaching the point that we'll actually take a look at nuclear energy. And there actually have been some little studies of the concepts, but we haven't done anything substantial. So what are some of the opportunities? Well, what I would like to see is that we look at some small modular reactor designs. That's something that when I went to grad school a couple decades ago, we thought we were going to get into. And I think we have the same opinion now. I think we're going to get into that. But I hope that the military, if we move into nuclear energy, can help take the lead and get that off the dime and get started. So the first generation nuclear reactors would be a nice start. And, of course, there are some commercial entities out there that are proposing small reactor designs. If the military would move forward, they might even help sort of examine that field and help us to get a better handle on what's going to go and what's not, or where things fit into their different niches. The other thing that I really think is important, I've heard a couple of people mention, is process iteration. When I went to school, people tended to study singular energy technologies. So you study a nuclear reactor, you study a coal plant, and the most complicated you got was, well, you have cogeneration. You can have heat plus electricity at a coal plant. But most of the energy technologies out there really don't provide a complete solution, and that's especially the case for the military. A nuclear reactor doesn't do any good on a forward operating base. and produces heat. So, or neutrons or whatever. But those aren't very useful if you're trying to kill the enemy, rebuild an economy, stabilize the society. You need to turn that into something. You probably need to store the energy, you need to use it at different points, use it in different forms. And so the real challenge, I think, is going to be to combine and integrate different technologies. How do I use the energy from the reactor to get things transported, to shoot down incoming missiles, to keep the TVs running at night? How can I combine it with the battery technologies that the soldier is carrying to power his radio? That's a really big opportunity. So a long-term approach I would anticipate within DoD is we're going to start out with some kind of studies. We're going to have to really get a better handle on what are the energy technology needs out there. And that's the real reason that I came back on active duty and working in Fort Monroe, where we look at the Army requirements, we figure out how we're going to fight the wars or how we're going to conduct operations in the future, and trying to get our arms around what does it take to operate in this future environment, which is changing. That's going to be a first step. If we can understand how the Army needs to be able to sustain itself in these diverse parts of the world, doing things we never thought we'd have to do, surviving against asymmetric threats. You never know when the guy you thought was your buddy or has a contract with you is going to turn around and walk in with a suicide bomb. Then we can start to design systems to accommodate that. So then the next step would be some kind of a demonstration. So let's say we're going to do nuclear energy technologies as something in the future. We figure out in the study phase how that nuclear technology might fit in. Then we're going to do some kind of a pilot demonstration phase. And so even if you look all the way down off to the right at an all-about long-term vision for deployable reactors, you're probably going to have, as an intermediate stage, some kind of a reactor on base. So you combine all of the reasons that you might build something like that. You build those all into the objectives that you're designing for, and you build a reactor on some U.S. base. And then you learn from that. And then finally, in the long term, you go out and you build this deployable reactor that you can take wherever you want. It's going to be safe. It's going to be proliferation resistant. And then in the really long term, you use that to help the world become safer and more sustainable and maybe less prone to fighting over energy. And instead of saying, we're not going to play in the nuclear business and assuming that's going to keep the world safe, we take a step forward and we work on better ways to do nuclear energy, and we share that with everybody so that everybody can be proliferation resistant and safe instead of going the cheap way. So with that, any questions I can answer? So.
Didn't I read that there was a proposal, I don't know if it was incorporated into law out of Congress, to require that the Navy look at lifters?
Kirk, are you the one who told me about that? Looking authority in particular?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was introduced. I'm not sure where it is now, if it has gone through to being passed. But so, it was introduced.
So far, the legislation I'm aware of already passed defense authorization, of course, required the Navy to take a look at nuclear for more ships. And so next generation cruiser, basically, they had to justify not going nuclear. There's pending legislation in this year's defense authorization that would require DOD to take a look at nuclear energy on installations. That was in the House bill, it wasn't in the Senate bill, and I think they're discussing that now. I think they're, if not today, within the next week, they're going to be on committee discussions.
Do you have to meet all the regulations from every locality in which it might be sited in the U.S.?
Oh, that's a good question. Was there any? I was going to say,
Congressman Sisak did a little video for us that we'll see tomorrow. But one of the points of it is that his legislation to require the Navy to spend $200 million. For a thorium reactor research program got stripped from the appropriations bill. But he has reintroduced it elsewhere, so we'll learn more about that tomorrow.
On the regulation, I probably should have at least mentioned that you may know that in 1954 we had an Atomic Energy Act that basically separated military and civilian applications, and so that was the origin of the authority the DOE and DOD have to have nuclear programs. And so the naval reactors are not overseas licensed, but they certainly maintain a rigorous program, and it's pretty defensible. So DOE does their things generally developmental, and so they come up with a program that suits the various sites. The Army has an Army Reactor Office that has authority over Army reactors. And it really hasn't been something that's been examined that much for some time because we haven't built any new reactors for a while. We've been basically shutting them down. But if we would end up moving forward on a reactor on installation or ultimately for something that you could deploy, that's kind of progressively harder from a regulatory standpoint. There clearly would have to be a significant discussion and potentially some new revisiting laws on the regulatory aspect. And so I think it's going to depend on what we decide is appropriate application. You know, what is the raw material need? And then what would be the right technology approach to that? And then based on that, you see what is the regulatory approach that fits. And so if it turns out that our long-term focus really is a military-unique reactor design that maybe someday would be deployed, but for now we're going to try it out on an Army base, then you probably have DOE and DOD teaming to permit the thing, and they'll probably, conceivably, they would end up with a little bit of legislative language that clarifies the Atomic Energy Act for this situation, and they might permit it under that authority. If the path forward looked more like we really are interested in more secure energy sources for communities to make the installations more secure, that looks a lot like making the grid less vulnerable, a lot like something that spreads out to civilian world and bleeds over, well, then that might make you tend to look more at an NRC approach, and you move forward either with NRC licensure at the beginning or certainly with a stronger sense that you're going to be moving into that realm soon. So the regulatory approach is going to be a really interesting part of this. Let's see how we do that. Question?
Yes. I started my career in the Navy nuclear program as a civilian, actually. But, it's been somewhat of a source of frustration to see that many of the technological advances that were developed in the Navy nuclear program have never really found their way into commercial application. And I'm just wondering, I applaud the roadmap that you described that where the small reactor development would eventually be commercialized and used for the better good of the United States and really the rest of the world. But I'm interested in knowing what would we do differently with this program then compared to the Navy nuclear program where we have not always been able to take advantage of that technology.
There are some people who even argue that, if you look at a naval reactor, it looks ideal to just sort of repackage and take over into theater as one of these expeditionary transportable reactors. Well, the environment is a little different. So whereas the naval reactors are kind of heavily guarded and we keep people away from them and we cover them up and everything, if we were going to put one on common spaces, but especially an expeditionary reactor, I think we would be more inclined to view those as things that we need to have low enrichment, not very proliferable, consider it more likely that somebody could only put their hands on it somewhere in the process between the factory and, you know, whatever gets decommissioned. Especially, let's say, you have to get out of some place quickly and you don't have time to take it with you. So I think we would necessarily design in some of the ruggedness, non-proliferation aspects and safety that, well, not so much safety, naval reactors, should I say, but those other aspects, the enrichment level and some of the design features, we deliberately make those a little simpler and maybe dumber and make them things that, you know, we just assumed everybody knew these things because instead of going to, say, the Russians and buying whatever reactor they're hawking next year, hopefully ours would be better. And we would rather that we don't have more Chernobyls, we have more three-mile islands. I mean, if somebody's going to have an accident, at least let's not have any consequences. So, question?
Could you give us an idea if bases, Air Force bases, Army bases in the U.S. are probably a first step, what kind of energy levels you would need in megawatts? So.
Well, most of the time that we talk about this, we think that it would be a larger forward operating base or a relatively larger base in the U.S. And so tens of megawatts tend to be the range. Some people have thought of a small reactor, say, to take overseas under 10 megawatts. I think more people tend to think, 30, 40, 50 megawatt size. Most of the bases that I've heard mentioned tend to be also about that range. The big question would be, what are you going to design into the system? So if you're going to combine technologies, and let's say you're going to do some kind of test bed capability, and you're going to produce synthetic hydrocarbons, you're going to do some other kind of application that uses some of the energy, then you need a margin above whatever the local demand is. But for the most part, you know, nominally, like a 50 megawatt size seems to be what people look at for the base needs. When we do the study, or if we do the study, one of the options I'm sure that we would look at is, rather than just providing enough for the base, why don't we look at the energy demand for the local community? And most of those communities, not being co-located with big cities, then, okay, maybe we're talking, 100, 200 megawatts, something like that. So it fits right into a lot of the concepts for small reactors.
Let me clarify that. The electrical at the end today, rather than the future, which is, water or, petroleum kind of products, other products, or electric army, if you will.
Right. So really, though, if you look at the sense of scale, then you're thinking at least tens of megawatts, and you're really not thinking of a 1,000-megawatt plant. So we're probably, between 30 and 300. Otherwise, we probably do it. We probably just let industry go out and build another 1,000 megawatt plant and build whatever systems are going to deliver. Sure.
One response to the regulations. I was designing a GMO reactor for naval reactors for NASA to fly wherever it was going to go. And that was just 3 years ago. And I spent a lot of time at a test site looking for a location to build a test facility for that. And Nevada got in the middle of it and said, wait a minute, you're not going to put a reactor out here without us looking at it. And the same thing, they wanted a test facility in Florida so they could test this thing before they flew it. And the same thing, Florida says, no, you're not going to build a reactor out here without us being involved. And some strict licensing requirements. And so the thing got defunded, and so we never went through that drill. But it was obvious that the states were very sensitive about, building a new reactor that hadn't been built for 30, 40 years on their property. even if it was on DOE land or you know, other land. And then finally, the Navy came to us and we did a study just in the last year. They wanted to take these reactors they're taking out of submarines with still 30, 40 years of life left in them and use those to put on their sites in Charleston or wherever. And we finished that study and it got shot down ultimately because of a highly enriched issue. They just didn't want to have to deal with that part of the issue. If you get less than 20%, we would talk about it, but it was a high enrichment that didn't happen.
Siting may or may not be easier for the military than for, say, a commercial utility, but it's certainly not a no-brainer. You still have anonymity attitudes or other or people who just want to make sure that they have a long process, a strong one.
So, the Army had a Sturgeon ship that had a naval reactor. Could you brief us a little bit about that possibility?
Yeah, Sturgis was, I think, the last power reactor that the Army operated pretty close. I think Fort Greeley and all were shut down before the Sturgis. Sturgis ran until about 73, I think, in Panama. That was a mobile, 50 megawatt or so.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. What was the power? Because that would be some kind of a goal to set up.
Yeah, I think it was around... something, it was like tens of megawatts, maybe 50, and it was, you know, the idea was that it would be transportable, so ultimately they took it down to Panama, plugged it in, ran the canal zone there for a number of years after the grid went out due to some hurricane. And so, of course, it's been defueled now, and the ship is sitting in probably a couple miles from my office in the York River. But, yeah, that was on the order of what we're talking about now. Maybe a different design.
What, the high enrichment or low enrichment? Because it seems like it's a stumbling block.
I don't think any of the Army reactors have a high enrichment. I think that was all regular, like a commercial fuel, a few percent.
Just another quick question. Making vehicle fuel is not too difficult. We've got a lot of choices, ammonia, methanol, all these different things. Right. What do you think the prospects are for jet fuel or aviation fuel?
Depends on what fuel you pick. I was an early advocate a long time ago of at least going to synthetic hydrocarbon fuel because that's a way to, if you take nuclear energy, provide the BTUs or the joules and use some other source of carbon, then you're only using the carbon to hang hydrogen atoms off it and make hydrocarbon fuel, another way to store hydrogen. And you don't have to recapitalize the vehicle thing. You qualify everything to run synth fuel, and at least for a near-term answer, you can use nuclear fuel, you can address the carbon footprint, and you can keep marching and spend your money on those technologies, not on all new vehicles. The next generation, I'm not an aviation engineer, so I'm not sure what you do when you rebuild the planes. With the little bit of background I have on propulsion and stuff, I'm not sure that I would expect the Air Force to, say, run ammonia through a lot of their jet turbines or anything. So,
you make hydrogen, make more energy to combine hydrogen with your carbon source. That's your percent.
Well, I mean, that's a way, certainly. And so that, to me, that seems like the most near-term option is to make a hydrocarbon fuel because you can still run the same engines. And then as you learn from that, and you learn about how reactors and, integrated systems work and the ins and outs of generating hydrogen in that way, then you can, the answer is going to be more obvious what your next step is, I think.
Sure. Hydrogen, you also get a solution to the water problem because burning hydrogen produces the water, so you can combine fuel cells technology to desalination or freshwater production technology.
Right, and there's a lot of fun to be had, I think, in analyzing all this stuff because, there's a lot of different parts of the world. So some places you have salty water, some places you have groundwater that's deep, some places it's humid, some places you're at sea. And so there's a lot of different ways to kind of crack the nut, and a lot of it depends on what you're trying to do and where. And so it gets back to that idea that the way that you combine energy technologies is really going to be a fun thing for our kids to do as their engineering projects.
A question about, again, back to the size. The read I got from you is that between 10 and 100 megawatts is optional, but air transportable is essential. Is
that right? Well, when you're talking hundreds of megawatts, I don't think people expect that you're going to air transport one package anyway. I think the air transportable relates to expeditionary needs over in a foreign base, and I think generally people are looking at, you know, tens of megawatts, you know, 10, 30, 50, somewhere in that range. And so, worst case, you could do something modular and move pieces. The 100 or 200 megawatt, I think those applications generally are going to be someplace that you're building up something bigger, and it's not air transportable. All the stuff there is big. Your air handlers and your, you know, infrastructure is all a bunch of new pieces. So, probably back to you.
Well, two or two and a half comments. Hydrogen burns pretty nicely in a regular internal combustion engine. You just need to modify a different fuel injection system. But the roadblock is the storage of hydrogen, which is a Phoenix problem. And but what I wanted to ask about, and this is probably why you're here at the Burning Conference, presumably, it's pretty obvious to you, want the expeditionary reactors to have the safest load possible. And same story, it is, of course, much more proliferation resistant. But what concerns me, there was an article in Scientific American maybe 25 years ago. It discussed the issue of the enemy at that time, it was the Soviet Union. What if they dropped a nuke right on a nuclear power plant and all the material in the core was dispersed? And they said it would be about 600 to 1,000 times the fallout of a one megaton bomb. And where I'm going with two tracks in this question, one you can't answer is, would a thorium-fueled large reactor, I mean, maybe you can, but I mean, it might be more for one of the thorium physicists, would a thorium-fueled reactor have less nasty daughter products and further actinides? And have you considered in the expeditionary reactor the ultimate scenario where, you know, a car bomb or a truck bomb hits it and just... how bad would it be? I think it's probably worse than the public thinks. I mean, we all, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? We all have excessive right. fear.
Yeah, I'll just hit that quick, and I think that's probably the last question.
Yep.
The concern that people really have when we look at this expeditionary scenario is, you know, what if somebody attacks the shoot with the bomb on it? We harden things against we harden things against enemy attacks.
Right.
And so we've got some science and technology associated with that. At the same time, we harden domestic reactors against various kinds of accidents. So we've got techniques to do some analysis that might be pretty applicable, and we've got some operational approaches that would play into there. And so I think being able to do the analysis on that is probably, you know, reasonable, and I'm fairly optimistic about how that would come out, because I think short of a nuke, you probably can prevent a really significant disproportionate consequence. I think that you could protect that as well as you protect some other hardened targets to the point that, you know, it's not like you contaminate half that part of the world. Nuke is kind of special case.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Again, that was Colonel Paul Rogge at the Thorium Energy Alliance Conference in October 2009. I hope you enjoyed this show. This is John Wheeler for This Week in Nuclear. Have a great day.